Hello and welcome to Trigonometry. I'm Francis Foster.
I'm Constantin Kissen.
And this is a show for you if you want honest conversations with fascinating guests.
Our brilliant guest this week is a wonderful comedian, Andrew Lawrence. Welcome to Trigonometry.
Oh, thanks for having me on. Yeah.
It's great to have you on.
It's nice to... It's the best review I've had for a while.
I should be a Guardian journalist, just to give you one good review.
Yeah, one decent comedy journalist.
Yes. It will be a long time before that happens, I'm afraid.
That one's for you, Steve.
Yes. Steve, no. What's his face?
Bennett.
Brian. Brian Logan.
Brian
Logan.
They're all the same.
Yeah. Anyway, they're all the same.
All these
the
white
racism
men.
Has started already. Perfect. All right. What we wanted to talk to you about is the sense I get from you. You want things to be fair and meritocratic.
Well, this is
but
what,
throughout
yeah.
your career, you felt like that wasn't happening, and there was a particular moment, I think, where all that came to a head for you.
Well,
so tell us about that.
I think, you can get to certain places. There was an element of meritocracy to it, but I was certainly very naive, and it is very naive to think that. You know, it's a business, and I didn't think that it would work on merit, but that's all I had. You know, I think, well, if I work hard, I'll get there. If I'm working harder than everyone else, and I'm better than everyone else, more talented than everyone else, getting a bigger reaction or more laughs on the night than everyone else, which is the only way to gauge these things, then I'll make some sort of progress. And the only progress I really wanted to make was to have some sort of quality of life financially and do my own touring shows. I wanted to play to my own audiences in sort of art centre venues, and I achieved that, and I still do that. And so I achieved what I wanted to do, but I became disillusioned because I thought it was a more kind of morally that it was a better industry than it was, and a more that there were values there, because it certainly there is a face to the comedy industry. There is a front to it that, especially now, that there's something ethical going on, that these are good people, which is not the case. It's like many other businesses. There's a lot of nastiness, a lot of corruption going on. And you expect that, and you just try your best, you work hard, and you see what happens. But, I certainly got disillusioned. But I did a show in 2000, and the summer of 2014 at the Edinburgh Fringe, by which time I'd parted company with the big, powerful agents that I'd been signed with, and I was now with a small independent agents, because I knew I'd sort of been chewed up and spat out. I knew I'd had my run, and now they were moving on, sort of leaving me behind, and it was other people's turn. It was the next thing was coming through, and people were bored of me now, and you know, that was all right as long as I was making a living. So I was signed with a smaller, more independent agent. I went up to Edinburgh with them, and a really, really good Edinburgh, really, really well received show, sort of predominantly kind of five stars and four stars, and then a few quite nasty reviews towards the end of the festival, quite political reviews. The show I did was called Reasons to Kill Yourself.
And, I saw it was a great show.
And the first 40-45 minutes of the show was just gag about being quite miserable and quite depressed naturally as a person, and about death as well. And then
I never would have figured you for that kind of person.
Then the last 15 minutes of the show I stopped doing the gag every 20 seconds, and it became a longer form bit for the last 15 minutes, which allowed me to kind of talk about my experience in stand-up comedy, and how I'd been quite naive, and I'd given a lot more of myself and sacrificed a lot more than I should have, thinking that there was the element of merit would see me through, and that it hadn't worked out, and that, you know, a side effect of that was that a relationship I'd been in with someone, I'd lived with her for 9 years, and she had also started out in comedy the same time as me, and she'd won a Channel 4 writing competition, and they'd done nothing for her, nothing, and she'd had 9 years of misery and no income, nothing, and it sort of, you know, it ruined her life really, because, you know, this guy running Channel 4 thought, oh, we'll have this new comedy writing initiative and it's a national thing and we'll do it, but then we will just, once it's done, it'll be good for me, it'll be good for my career because I've done this thing, but whoever wins, we just won't care about them, we'll brush them under the carpet. But so that relationship came to an end, and I was sort of angry for her, and I was quite sort of feeling sorry for myself, and it was a powerful show, I think. It was very, very funny for those 45 minutes, and then that last 10, 15, I felt like I was saying what I wanted to say, but also what I felt a lot of other comics and a lot of people coming into the industry, like I wanted them to hear before they made the sacrifices and commitments that I had made, I suppose. So it went very well, and I the Edinburgh Fringe, nothing came of it because because I was done, I'd had my run, and it didn't matter how well I did up there, I was sort of, you know, I was yesterday's news, and I've been chewed up about, and that's fine because I was still doing well, I was still on tour. October that year, I posted, and I was sort of starting to post more on Facebook and Twitter and than I had previously.
You can see where this is going if you don't understand.
I was going to say that's always a good idea, as I have found.
Yeah.
For because so many of the people coming to see me, and of course they're following me on social media, whatever. If I've got whatever it is, 20,000 on Twitter or whatever. I don't know what I've got, but there's a lot of people there that buy tickets and try to be funny all the time and try and engage with those people on social media, and that's what I was doing all the time. And one post that I put on Facebook got picked up by certain people within the comedy industry, some quite successful people within the comedy industry who were really pissed off with what I'd said, and decided they were going to go on a bit of a run with it.
What did you say, Andrew? Because I wasn't, as I say, I wasn't a comic at the time, so I didn't follow it.
Well, there were three strands to it. The first, I think, it was about how panel shows, there'd been too many cheap and easy jokes about UKIP on panel shows, and that I felt like it was out of touch. I felt like this was 2014, before we'd have a referendum on Brexit. I felt like it was out of touch. I felt that, this is what I put in the post, that actually UKIP were resonating with a lot of people, and that I think comedians are a little bit in a bubble. And they hadn't.
Well, that's a mild understatement, right there, isn't it?
They were sort of alienating people by not realizing that. And I said that people were getting on those panel shows not based on merit, but based on the fact they were ticking boxes, equality and diversity boxes, which is true and remains true. It's a primary reason for people being booked for comedy panel shows and for stand-up shows on the BBC and on Channel 4. And the third strand of the post was that, following on from saying a lot of people resonated with UKIP because a lot of people were quite upset about, in recent years, there'd been a mass uncontrolled level of immigration, which had put enormous strain on public services, on housing, and it had been a cynical thing. It had been something that had been done to push a lot of unskilled labour into the job market, so wages for the poorest, lowest paid people could be kept artificially low because there was such a demand for those jobs, and 0 hours contracts could be rolled out. And those are the three strands of the post. But of course, within that, there's a lot within that that you can use if you want to go for someone, if you want to attack someone. There's a lot in there you can use to say, oh, you're this, you're that. You're saying that, but what you mean is this. And this was right at the start of where that became a regular occurrence on social media, on Facebook and Twitter, that there'd be these sort of mass kind of pylons where people would go for someone who had expressed a viewpoint that they didn't agree with, and sort of manipulate what they had said out of all proportion, and try to smear and discredit them. And it became, I think that was at the start of that. And of course, it happened to so many people, but it was a shock, an enormous shock in comedy, because it was right at the start of that.
Well, you kind of got cancelled before that was like the cool thing to happen to, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I think
you're a trailblazer.
I don't. It's difficult because to know the extent, and there is an extent to which I was cancelled. There is an extent to which after I put that post up, it affected me work wise. Definitely, I lost a lot of work because of that post.
Yeah,
I lost a lot of work because of that. At the same time, I can't say that I don't think it cost me any sort of, let's say, TV work or further work. I had a sitcom in development that I carried out and went through with BBC Radio 4, but I don't think it cost me any work in broadcasting because the parameters had changed there and they wanted people. There was an equality and diversity agenda, rightly or wrongly, I don't care. But that's how it is. They wanted people who were ticking certain boxes, and ability or comedic ability was secondary to that political agenda. And so I was out the door already because of that. So putting that post up, you know, wasn't going to affect that. It certainly, I was just out on tour at that point. I wasn't doing club gigs because I didn't need to. I was just touring. But there were certainly venues that wouldn't book me, that had booked me a lot in the past, regardless of the fact they hadn't seen the show that I was doing.
So you got put in the box, basically.
That's what happened. Based on that Facebook post or what they'd read about it somewhere,
right,
or what they read about it on someone else's Twitter feed or read about it in an online blog or something, based on that they decided they didn't want to.
Well, let me ask you something, because are you happy with the way that you phrased what you said in that post? Because
I remember when
we had Simon Evans on the show, great comedian, one of the things he said is that a lot of people in the comedy industry agreed with you. And he did.
Yeah.
But the way you phrase some of the points that you made, which in my opinion are perfectly legitimate and valid points for someone to have, whether I personally agree with them or not. The way he said that he felt the way you phrased some of that, something about female comedians pretending to be comedians or something. I don't know if that's the right quote, but like he felt that he was much more difficult for people to defend you.
Oh, it's very loaded, but that was where the humour was in there. And don't forget, the reason why I was putting these posts up on Facebook and on Twitter was to try and entertain and amuse the audience, my audience of ticket buyers who come to see my shows. That's who it was for. It's not me phoning up comedians or agents or TV production companies or sending them an email or
you're a bit shit, mate.
Exactly.
You're only there because you're a woman.
Well, they saw it because it's...
Yeah.
They want to look at the pages up to them. Someone else shared it. Someone shared it with them, and which is fine. But, you know, it wasn't intended for them. And there's no reason why they should have bothered it with it anyway. They might have looked at it and thought, well, I don't agree with that, and moved on. But they didn't want to do that. Mm. They wanted to do more than that. And the expression I used, I think, very difficult, 2014, I said that comics were being booked for comedy shows based on their gender, ethnicity, sexual orientation at the time. And I think I said there were women posing as comedians on panel shows, which there were. There were comedy panel shows with comedians, and there were women who were comedians on there who were open spots, essentially, who were doing open spots or middle spots at gigs, who had been fast-tracked.
How things haven't changed.
That, for me, that is a harsh way of putting it, but I'm afraid you are, if you're an open spot, yeah, or a middle spot who's just starting to be paid at gigs, and you have been fast-tracked into Live at the Apollo, which was what was Mock the Week, yeah, which was what was happening then, because they wanted female comedians. If that's who you were, then you were still learning your craft. You were posing as a comedian. Mm. You weren't there yet. You were getting there. And it's certainly a harsh phrase, but if you were reading it as someone who goes to see comedy, buys tickets for an Andrew Lawrence comedy show, it's the harshness of the phrase is quite funny, because the very fact that I've written the post at all is risky. Back then it's even risky, because it flies in the face so much of what the mentality and the ethos of the comedy industry was and was back then and is now. It was so, there's such a sort of biting the hand that feeds you exercise. That's where the humour was, the audacity and the cheek of doing that. That's why it was funny, which is galling to have to explain it. Mm. It's galling to have to explain it, because people got that, and then people chose to ignore that as well. And when Simon Evans says, oh, I didn't agree with what he says.
That's not what he said, actually.
Or no, he said, I didn't agree with the way he phrased it, or whatever he said then. He's missing the fact that it wasn't intended for him and it wasn't intended for the comedy industry. Why on earth would I bother wasting my time putting a post on social media for anyone else than the people who buy tickets to see my shows? And also, it's not as if I was the first person, the first comic to criticise and take the piss out of Mock the Week. I think a lot of people have been saying it was bad for a very long time and continue to say it's bad online. A lot of comics.
So you put the post up,
yeah,
and you saw the reaction. There must have been a bit of you, Andrew, that must have thought, for fuck's sake, what have I done here? Do you regret putting that post up?
I felt, no, I don't. Well, I wouldn't have put it up if I'd known the reaction. It's still up there now, so the content of it I'm happy with. I regret the reaction. If I knew the reaction, I wouldn't have put it up. But at that point, I felt detached from the comedy industry anyway, at that point, because all I was doing was going, and this was the extent of my job, was I was going to art centre venues. I didn't have a support act. I didn't have a tour manager, anything like that. I'd go to my art centre venues. I'd meet the technician, and we work out the lights and the sound, and I'd do my show, and I'd go home. So I was detached from the whole comedy industry, and had been for probably a year or more, because I wasn't really seeing other comedians, socially or other, or gigs. I wasn't doing TV or radio, really, at that point. I was just doing those tour dates. So, and these people who were suddenly, comics who were suddenly leaving comments or messaging me on social media, many of whom I'd never met before in my life, and some that I had, I thought, well, why are you talking to me now? I haven't talked to you in years, you know. Feel free to come and chat to me anytime on social media, but I have no idea you're even following me or looking at my posts. And so it was odd, and my reaction was, well, just leave it. I felt like I wasn't part of... I felt like I was apart from it. You know, that it had never been my politics, the politics of the comedy industry. I don't know what I am. It changes all the time politically. I'm quite, you know, without sounding poncy, I'm quite nihilistic. I struggled to find any real sort of meaning or have any real fixed views constantly, you know, at different times. I think different things, but I'm not really committed.
Some men just want to see the world burn, Andrew.
Well, I'm just not really committed to anything. Do you know what I mean? I'm not really, which is nihilism, isn't it? I'd always felt sort of an outsider in the stand-up industry to that degree, in green rooms, in dressing rooms, and on TV things. I felt like an outsider, but then you step on stage and it feels like you're at home.
Yeah.
You know, you feel, well, this is it. I know where I am, what I'm doing here. This is perfect. I don't want to do anything else. But that, I don't know what my politics are. I don't have any fixed politics. All I knew was I wasn't that sort of sanctimonious, self-righteous, sort of faux liberal thing that has existed in comedy long before any of us started. But I felt like I could do it anyway. I was allowed to do stand-up comedy. I didn't have to be that thing, but maybe I did. Maybe you do have to be that thing. But
it was very much marketed, Andrew, as when it happened.
Yeah.
As in, Andrew Lawrence has now gone right wing. Andrew Lawrence has now turned to the dark side.
Well, I think that was, it was one particular journalist at the time picked up on it specifically, which was a guy called Steve Bennett, who runs a comedy website called Chortle. And when I put this Facebook post up, I think there were three articles about me on the homepage of the website. It's very unusual because I'm not well known. You know, even at the peak of the work I was doing, I still occasionally get recognised once every couple of weeks. Someone says, "Oh, you're that comic," but then it might happen every sort of, if I was out and about, maybe once every 3 days or something, but. And I'll wear a hat all the time anyway because I hate all that. But I wasn't well known, so there was no. There was something extra there. The fact that he picked up on it, thought I'm going to run with this, and I'm sure he was getting hits. It must have been that he was getting a lot of hits on his website for it.
Did the same thing with me when I turned down that contract. He did exactly the same thing.
And there was none of.
Yeah, you were going to make a joke about Steve Bennett. You can't miss this opportunity.
No. I'm just saying, it never happened to me because I'm a good person. Not like the rest of you pricks.
But Andrew, what really happened with you? It seems to me is that. Yeah. You tread on a landmine, which maybe you weren't even aware of at the time, which is we all know, and even the people who advocate for the diversity thing, they know what they're doing, which is they're promoting people who are not. And I don't say this as a criticism of them because it's not their fault. No. But there are people who are being pushed because of, as you say, they tick a certain box.
Yeah.
And you... It seems to me like you tread on that landmine because maybe you hadn't realized how toxic an issue it was because you were really saying the emperor's naked when no one wanted to hear that.
I don't mind. Do you know what? I don't even mind it. I don't mind that people get opportunities for that reason. What I want people to do is admit that it's happening.
Yeah.
Because there's other people who aren't getting opportunities because of this political agenda. So if you're that person who's got this opportunity because you've ticked that box, at least have the humility to acknowledge that and know that. And actually some comedians do to great comedic effect. You know, I think Ramesh Ranganathan, who I love, I think he's a great comic and he's a nice guy. He went on. I saw him go on a few shows and he'd open by saying, "Don't worry, guys, doesn't matter whether I'm funny, I'm only here to tick a quality or diversity box," or something like that. It's very funny.
Yeah.
But he also knows there's truth to that as well.
Yeah.
And he knows that and he's saying, and I respect that. And also, I've seen, I think I saw, well, it's his joke. I've seen other comics do it, but I'm not going to give him credit for doing it because he's the first that I saw do it. So I have respect for that. And I think I'm a real believer in that, popular expression, stay humble or be humbled. I just want people to admit that it's going on, and some, because it is, isn't it? It's all a little bit clandestine.
It is, and you know, and then we see people getting promoted, and we're like, hang on, you're not that good. I've seen you struggle. You touched on faux liberalism, which I find really, really interesting within the comedy industry, in that everyone pretends to be liberal, everyone pretends to be woke. Why have we got this pressure when really comedians are always dreadful people?
Yeah, well, it's
you only think that because you work with me.
Yeah,
I think it's an odd thing, isn't it, to want to devote your life to go step on stage and trying to make strangers laugh. And I don't think I think a lot of the time it doesn't come from a good place. It's very difficult, the sanctimony, the self-righteousness, the faux liberalism, the posturing. You think, is this knowingly deceitful? Are they knowingly putting on this front, or is it a sort of mass hysteria? Is there a cult? Is it a cult? You know what I mean? Because if you've got a little bit of faith in humanity, you think, I don't want to think that it's a deceit. They're doing it because they think it would help their career. I don't want to think that. I want to think it's because it's got into their head. Because
it doesn't have to be that devious, cult, though, Andrew. Does it? Because I was talking to somebody at a comedy club the other day, and he was saying to me, "Oh, I really like the way you talk about politics because I can't do it." And I was like, "What do you mean you can't do it?" And he went, "Well, I'm just a straight white guy. Born British, therefore, if I start talking about my opinions, I'm going to get destroyed." There's also just an element of survival instinct for some people. Do you know what I mean?
It's not abject fear.
Yeah, well, it's not like they've sat down and gone, "Oh, what's the best way to advance my career?" They maybe just don't want to get crushed.
The trouble is, if you're a good comic, you go for what's difficult. What's the one thing people? What's the one thing? Where there's jeopardy in me making jokes about it, because if you get it right, there's a risk. The risk reward thing is, if you tackle that subject that could ruin you and you get it right, the reaction, the whole room explodes, laughter, people doubled over with laughter. If you get it wrong 10 years ago, you'd probably die for the rest of the gig, didn't matter, you start again at the next gig. If you get it wrong this now, it's could be your whole career over. It could be as a comedian. So the risk reward is much greater, but there is a positive to that, in as much as it is quite an exciting time to watch those comics say those things and take those risks where you think this could ruin you, but you're getting it right and it's hilarious. Because if those comics said the same thing 10 years ago, if Patrice O'Neill, who's arguably the best of all time, one of the best of all time, Patrice O'Neill, said the things he said, whatever it was, I don't know.
Why can't I harass you?
Well, if he's, whatever he, the things he said on stage, what are we going to say, 15 years ago? He said them then and they were, and it was brilliant. If he said them now and got away with it, which he would, imagine how much fun it would be because of the jeopardy and the joy that it would give you, thinking you can do it.
It's like the Chappelle special or Ricky Gervais
at the Golden Globes.
Exactly.
People are crying out for it.
Watching those Chappelle specials in recent years is exciting. What's he gonna? He's gonna. But Bill Burr as well, and Andrew Schultz as well. Yeah. Andrew Schultz in this country would not, if he was starting out, wouldn't get a gig. He'd be blacklisted everywhere. He would be blacklisted. He would not play anywhere, I think.
Okay, so that's a great point. So but why do you think we have this urge to blacklist people?
It's a difficult word, isn't it? Blacklist. It might be the wrong.
Or suddenly, you know, shun or whatever else.
Punish people for having the wrong opinion or the wrong type of comment.
But you see, it's all done very carefully. There's nothing. It so much of it isn't overt. But you see Alistair Williams talk about how I can't play the clubs that used to book me won't book me, and my career's over because I put this video up about Brexit, which was a funny video. You should watch it if you haven't. Alistair Williams, Brexit Burger King, is a very funny video, and he says, I put this video up and now my career's finished, comedy career's finished. And I'm sure a lot of people look at that and think, really? Yeah, you sure? I'm not. I think you're playing up to this a little bit, but I know, because I've been there. That actually there are clubs that won't book him now. And for him, the difference between those clubs that won't book him, that were booking him, who are not booking him now, is the difference between making a living and not. So by putting that video up and these clubs not booking him anymore, he's not able to make a living from stand-up, potentially, which means he can't focus on what he's doing full-time. He's got to find some other source of income. And it's very, very damaging to him as a comedian in developing, going to do gigs and writing and coming up with new material, because now he's got a lot of money worries about how he's going to pay his bills, when actually his diary should be full. Every weekend should be full in his diary, because he's a good comic and he delivers... and he's reliable, and he's not controversial. Actually, you can look at some of the stuff he posts online and think he's controversial, but you put him in a club anywhere on a weekend and he'll deliver, and he's a very reliable act. So people should book him. And I know he's not lying. There are clubs that, because touring venues, some of them stop booking me. And even this time around, my tour this time around, I sent them a copy for the blurb for the show to promote the show that they put on their website, whatever it is, 100 words or something. And based on that, not a word of the show. They haven't seen the show. They don't even know what the show is before, or what the content of the show is before they've booked it in. Two venues on this show, on this tour, booked my show in. Contracts all done. Got the copy for the show. So we're not doing this. So they had to pay me a cancellation fee because they wanted to cancel the show, which is fine. I don't have to make the journey.
You found a great way to cash in.
Money
cash in on your notoriety. Yeah.
Money, I came to playing less and less touring venues. So I thought, I want to stay sharp. I'll go back and do the clubs. But then when I went back to try and do the clubs that I'd headlined for years and years, regularly, suddenly I wouldn't talk to me, wouldn't return my emails, my phone calls, nothing, they wouldn't talk to me, and frozen out by some bookers who know that if they put me on the bill, I've got the TV credits that will sell the tickets. They know I'll deliver because I've been doing it so long. They know I'm not controversial. They know that. And this is the thing. I'm not, even the Facebook post, I've never put anything on social media that has got me suspended or any kind of ban from social media. Never, not once.
I wish we could say that.
And yet there's this false impression out there of me of being a controversial comedian, which has been generated by this journalistic input. At the time I put that Facebook post up, the Chortle website, Steve Bennett, guy who runs it, put three articles about me on the homepage of his website, which is unusual because no one knew who I was, really. I'm not well known. And he sort of, it was obviously getting hits for him, probably predominantly from people within the comedy industry. So he ran with it and made a lot more of it than there was, and made it into something a lot more controversial than it was. And then I think The Independent as well at the time, which was still a newspaper rather than just an online blog, published some stuff about me as well, because I thought, well, this will get people clicking online, which was quite far removed from anything that I'd put up on social media, but they wanted the clicks for their advertising or whatever.
Speaking of advertising, before Francis asks you our last question, because we're out of time, you're about to go on tour. At the time this comes out, you may already be on tour, which is called Pale, Male and Stale. Great title.
Pale, Male and Stale tour.
So where can people get tickets for that? I'm sure it'll be at least as funny as this interview, if not more.
I saved all my best stuff.
How do people get tickets?
You can come to my website, andrewlawrencecomedy.co.uk, and it's just a staggered tour. It's all on the website. If you feel like coming along.
All right. Go and see Andrew. He's a very, very, very funny comedian.
There was one question I wanted to ask, which before we wrapped up, and I kept trying to ask it, going away.
Sure.
The thing I loved about your comedy, I still am a massive fan, but when I first, as an open spot, one of my favourite comedians, genuinely. Yeah. And the reason is because you would have, with your jokes, I would describe as a beautiful savagery to the way you write.
Mm. Yeah.
And I look at Mock the Week, and I look at a lot of these, satirical panel shows or people on TV, and it's fucking boring. Comedy to me should be about saying the truth, however unpleasant it may be, and just hitting that bullseye.
Yeah.
And that's what audiences, that's what deep down we go and see comedians. That's why we worship the Pryors, the Patrice O'Neills, your Bill Hickses, your Joan Rivers, people who come out. Why has it become so boring?
Well, I think it always, the sort of comedians you're talking about are predominantly American comics, and I think there's a lot more you can do in America as a stand-up. I think for a lot of years, not anymore, but when I started out, probably until 4 or 5 years ago, the BBC was what you aim for, and to get on there, you had to water down what you do, and I did that, and a lot of acts did it as well, and because you want to earn some money, you don't want to live in a dump, if you've got a family, you got kids to support, and mortgages to pay, and nursery fees. You love stand up, but you got to find the money from somewhere, and if you're looking, the further you go away from stand-up to look for alternative streams of income, the worse you get at stand-up, because you need to be giving it your full focus. You can't do it half-assed. You have to give it everything, absolutely everything, to be good at it, to be really good at it. You have to, there can't be anything else, I think.
Andrew, so before we let you go, the last question we always ask is, what is the one question that no one's talking about, the one issue that no one's talking about that we should be talking about?
Yeah, do you know what? It's difficult because it's all out there, isn't it? It's all out there somewhere. Mm. There's too much talking. there's too much talking. I think...
All right, that's it. We're shutting down trigonometry. End the conversation. Hashtag no debate.
I think there needs to be more discussion about... social media and how it's regulated or not regulated, as the case may be, and about I think and a lot more exploration of its impact on people's lives. I think we're just scratching the surface of that. I think things the Facebook and Twitter, Instagram are now having a profound impact on a lot of people's lives, and I think there has to be some acknowledgement of that first of all, but I think there has to be a lot of discussion about that. Not enough discussion about that, I think, takes place.
Right, well,
good answer.
It's a great answer, and it's actually very, it's very prescient, because as a former teacher, I've seen the effect, you know, children completely addicted to smartphones, all the rest of it being on it till 2 a.m, 10, 11-year-olds. Yeah. But thank you very much for coming on the show, Andrew. If people want to find you on social media, ironically enough, where can they do that?
At Andrew Lawrence on Twitter, I guess.
I love the way you had to think about it. It's just, it's your own name.
Yeah.
By the way, well done on getting the fact that you're a former teacher into yet another episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
Good stuff.
Yep.
As always, make sure you follow Andrew. Check him out. He's very, very funny stand-up. Make sure you go see him on tour. Really, really great comic.
As deeply always, problematic.
Deeply problematic. Male, pale, and stale. There you go. And as always, follow us at TriggerPod, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, etc. And we'll see you in a week's time with another brilliant episode.
Take care. See you next week, guys.
Guys, let us take a minute to recommend another podcast.
Did you know the average podcast listener has 6 shows in rotation? So you're most likely not just listening to Trigonometry. Wait. So we know you're cheating on us. This is a disgrace.
Francis, it's okay. The Jordan Harbinger Show is a perfect complement to Trigonometry.
Really?
Absolutely. Just like Trigonometry, Jordan hosts weekly mind-broadening conversations with some of the most fascinating people in the world. But a key difference that I'm a big fan of is that Jordan is focused on pulling actionable, growth-orientated advice from his guests.
I'm looking at his episode list now. There's an episode here where Jordan talks to a hostage negotiator from the FBI who lays out his techniques on how to get people to do what you want them to do by making them like and trust you. Sounds just like me. Except, you know, I'm more SAS.
You can't go wrong with adding the Jordan Harbinger Show to your podcast rotation. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show, that's HARBINGER, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.